argument is Deitcher versus Evansville. Ms. Eberle.
May it please the court. We're asking for a new trial on damages during the trial of a violation of the Driver's Privacy Protection Act. Because during the trial, the district court gave the deliberating jury an answer to a jury question.
You know what I find strange about this argument? If the jury asks a question, you know, when was the case filed? If the judge says, I won't tell you, What do the jurors think? They think, what, we can't be told when the case was filed? What's going on?
The judge could have simply have said, this fact was not admitted into evidence.
Well, but look, the way an ordinary human being responds is to say, why does it have to be in evidence when the case was filed? You don't have people coming up and testifying, oh, I think the case was filed 1920, and I think it was filed in 1890, things like that. It's just everyone knows when it's filed.
Well, Your Honor.
You want? So I'm worried about a situation where the jurors, by being given such a strange answer to their question, begin to worry about things that really are irrelevant. They say, why won't he tell us when the case was filed?
Well, Your Honor. The judge could have told them when the case was filed, but put in a limiting instruction saying you're supposed to decide base the verdict only on relevant information. This was never introduced into evidence. Neither party thought it
well,
was relevant.
Well, did you or whoever was handling the case say to the judge, look, if you're going to answer this question, make it clear to the judge that, you know, you asked the question, so I'm answering it. But it's not germane to your deliberations, right? That would be a good way to handle it. Did you or whoever, I don't know if you were the lawyer in the district court, say to the judge that's what you should say?
Well, the judge himself said it was meaningless.
Right. And then
he said to you it was meaningless.
Right. Yeah, so he acknowledged it was meaningless.
Sure. Yeah, but that's not the point. The point is his reaction was the jury asked me a question. There's a clear answer. You don't want the jury. You don't want to treat the jury like. You know, if they ask you a question, you either answer it or you at least tell them why you're not answering, so they're not left baffled at what's going on, or what mysteries are being concealed from them. So you could have suggested to the judge, you know, make clear they're interested, so you answer their question, but you explain to them it's not a relevant issue. It's not an issue in the case.
Yes, Your Honor, we could have said that, and we probably should have said that. However, at the time, we believe that really what they were asking for was a different date, and it was very important that if they didn't know, if they wanted to be reminded of this, the date, we believed, the date the defendants learned of the claims against them.
You mean the notice of the notice of claim?
Exactly.
So I think it's plausible to think that jury confused the date of the notice of claim.
Exactly.
Of the lawsuit. Suppose that after Judge Shabazz informed the jury of the date that the lawsuit was filed, he reopened arguments and let both argue the relevance of that date. What would you have said to the jury about this?
Of the date that the case was filed? That there is no importance to it whatsoever. It was simply when we got around to finishing the complaint and found
But your opponent didn't think it was significant either, right?
That's true. So that's why I believe it wouldn't.
But then what's the harm, right?
Well, the harm is first either they thought.
If there was harm to you, your opponent would not have objected.
I'm sorry.
If if this information was going to hurt you, your opponent would not have objected. Right?
Oh, well,
you said, great, Judge, tell him.
Well, Your Honor, at the time, perhaps the defendants weren't thinking, you know, maybe.
Well, they weren't thinking, you weren't thinking, so why should we reverse on that?
Well, I think the defendants were just being honest and saying it was never admitted into evidence, so
it shouldn't
be.
They obviously didn't care, right?
True, they didn't know how it would be used either. But they did object, and at the time, after we both objected, we argued strenuously that we believe they were really looking for.
Why would it make a difference to their verdict when the case was filed?
Well, Your Honor, like we argued, if they were actually looking for the other date.
And that other date was in evidence, right?
It was in evidence.
Right.
We had an exhibit that contained that date, and
right.
We had asked earlier for that to go back to the jury room, and the judge didn't allow it. So then when this discussion came up later when the jury question was asked, we asked again, you know, at least send the exhibit back to the jury room. So then if they are mistaken, asking for the wrong date, then they'll see that this is the correct date. So that would have been another way to solve it, and that's what we had asked the judge to do, but he again refused.
Now, just to be absolutely certain, there was no reference to the timing of the lawsuit during the
none whatsoever. Nothing.
And put in perspective again the timing of the filing of the claim. I understand your case because you're saying there was this huge fraud, all these documents were falsified after the notice of claim had been filed.
Right.
So just give me just the nutshell timeline. As it relates to the claim and then the filing, because all this activity took place before the filing of the lawsuit.
Right. So the event happened in February. In April, we sent the defendants a notice of claim saying that we're going to bring charges, we're going to file a suit. Then in May, the police report regarding the incident 2 months ago was finalized. So we argued that it was finalized and changed after they learned of our claims in April. So that was our theory. Then when we filed the case, that was after all of that. That was in June. So if the jury wanted to be reminded of when the defendants learned of the case, if they thought it was the June date that the judge gave them, well, then they would look, oh, well, the police report was finished in May.
And let me ask you another question then. In terms of this document, you know, was the notice of claim, you said that was an exhibit that was marked, right? And that was a fully admitted exhibit?
Yes, fully admitted.
And so did any exhibits go back to the jury?
Yes.
So why didn't that exhibit go back?
We asked the judge, and he denied it.
No, I mean initially, when because obviously at the close of the evidence, the instructions were given, exhibits are going back. Each side gets to inspect the exhibits.
Right.
So why was that exhibit pulled?
Judge Shabazz does not let all of the exhibits go back to the jury room.
How does he make a determination about what goes and what doesn't?
He asks each side, which exhibits do you want, and we mark on a piece of paper. And then he goes through each one and decides whether or not it should go back. I believe the defendants objected.
But these are exhibits that have been admitted
exactly.
into evidence?
Exactly.
And he chooses what goes back and
yes.
what doesn't, and they've been admitted?
Exactly.
And the jury has seen them, or they've
yes.
been read from, or they've been... Was that document distributed to the jury or published in any way to the
it
jury?
It was put on the overhead projector.
And shown to the jury?
And shown to the jury several in our opening and throughout our argument.
What percentage of the admitted evidence would you say and how much to the jury room and how much did the judge refuse to let in?
What's that noise?
I haven't touched it, but I'll move it up. When I moved it up, I had it down. Okay.
What percentage? I'd have to only guess. I would say he probably 70% of it went back of the ones we asked that we said.
But you haven't
like
objected
to
that.
I'm sorry?
You haven't objected to his not sending exhibits back.
At the time, we did object.
You don't object in your brief. It's not one of your grounds for reversal.
That he didn't let the...
Right, right.
We didn't explicitly object to
we
that.
We didn't implicitly object either.
I'm sorry? Right.
You didn't object.
Right.
You didn't
well, we mentioned that he didn't
You didn't make it a ground for reversal.
That in itself, not letting...
Right.
Well, we said that we asked for...
I know what you say, but you're brief. You're not saying to us, reverse because, either singly or in combination with other errors, he didn't allow all the exhibits to go back to the jury.
No, we did not make that a ground.
And weren't you able to argue about this timing?
I'm sorry?
In your closing argument, weren't you able to make these points about the timing? That they had destroyed documents after receiving the notice of claim.
Yes, we made that argument
you did
in
make
our closing,
that.
Yes.
Right. So the jury had your argument.
Had it, but if they wanted to verify it, if they wanted to say now, they actually had the police report back with them, so that would show the May date. If they wanted to say, you know, are these plaintiffs being honest, let's see the date that they learned of the claim. So they asked, well, it's not here. You know, let's verify it.
So did you suggest to the judge at this argument over whether he should answer the question that he should give them that exhibit?
Exactly, yes.
But then why aren't you objecting here that he didn't give the exhibit? I don't understand.
Is it because that's his normal routine way of running his courtroom?
Yes, yeah, that is his way of
so
running the courtroom.
So you... feared saying anything about it, or
no? We asked, and when we asked Judge Shabazz to for a new trial, we said it should have been given back to him. I don't think I'm
in the motion for a new trial. You did say
yes.
that exhibit should have been tendered to the jury. So
yes.
Yeah, why didn't you make that argument up here directly? I mean, because that to me is a very substantial argument. I mean, exhibits that are all in evidence, to my way of thinking, should all go to the jury. We're not talking about exhibits that were admitted for demonstrative purposes, right? You're talking about straight up admitted in the evidence, shown to the jury, published during the entire trial, and then at the end of the case, the judge deciding what goes in and what doesn't.
Uh-huh.
With no discussion as to the basis for it. I mean, because we're not talking about millions of exhibits. So from a practical standpoint, we have to say, well, what's most crucial and does everybody agree we put in a lot of junk that doesn't need to go back? That's not what the issue is. The issue is just not sending some back because he doesn't want to send them back, I guess.
Okay. Well, I guess I see it all as the same thing. The jury asked the question.
Why does he do this, Judge Shabazz? Why are you so passive about
right.
it?
Well, I guess because I see it all as the same question. The judge...
Look,
there was
I don't understand. I have Judge Williams's question. Why would a judge not send admitted exhibits into the jury room? Why isn't it automatic?
Well,
has he ever given a reason for that?
In when we had asked for it to go back, he said... No.
I'm not talking about this exhibit. Does he have a reason why he doesn't send all the exhibits into the jury room?
I don't know.
You said that he sent about 70% of what you requested back.
I believe so. I mean, I've never.
What
so
is
there
that?
Were 30. There was 30% of things that you wanted that jury to have, which had already been admitted, that you didn't object to going back, or 28% since?
So you're asking, were there other exhibits that we wanted to go back that
right.
the judge said could not
right.
go back?
Right.
I believe there were a few.
And
was this done in front of the jury,
no.
or no?
And was this done on the record?
Yes.
So he just
said, so there's a record of it.
of which ones went back and which ones didn't.
Yes.
So, now that was before the, of course, the jury question. So when he said, I'm sending X, Y, Z back, but not A, B, C, did you object then?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, what did you say, that everything should go back?
No, that's not the procedure in his courtroom. I didn't challenge his procedures in his courtroom.
Mm-hmm. Why not?
Because Judge Shabazz would not. It would have been futile. That it's Judge Shabazz's courtroom. He makes the rules.
And let me ask you, is this rule in writing somewhere, or is this just known when he tries a case that he makes a judgment at the end on what exhibits go back or not?
I have not seen it in writing.
Okay. But this is a procedure that is I take it, longstanding, because you don't seem to be surprised by this procedure like
this
we
was
are.
This is my first trial in front of Judge Shabazz.
So you don't know whether he's done this, whether this is...
I believe it's longstanding.
Okay.
Now, when he said this, did you just say, well, do you just want the notice of claim to go in? Is that what you said?
When he asked about the jury question?
No. When he announced before the jury started deliberations what he was going to send to the jury room,
mm-hmm.
and he designated some that he would send, did you say to him, add the notice of claim?
We filled out a sheet, and you check out which ones you want to go back. So I assume this is his procedure, since he
right.
has his sheets.
Right. This was his sheet that he gave
sheets,
you all
right.
to fill out.
You check out. The defendants check what they want to go back. If we check something that they don't check, then the judge comes out and makes a decision as to whether or not he'll allow it to go
so
back.
So you check the notice of claim?
Yes.
And he said what? No
he
notice
said,
of claim?
No. This is it's lease pendants. It's
what?
Not going
what?
Back. It's lease pendants.
List pendants, yeah.
Sorry.
So what did you say? Did you object? You say, well, I need that. They have to have that.
I don't believe there was further discussion on it.
Wait a second. Did you object? Did you say, look, I need that. I need that notice of claim that I checked. That's essential.
I don't believe so.
Well, that's serious. I don't know why he's doing this. I don't know why he's doing this. But
we did object very strenuously.
Later, yeah.
Right, but then why couldn't he have just sent it back?
Well, of course, one of the reasons he wouldn't send it back then is that it gives that a great deal of prominence, right?
Well, instead
Look,
he gave
his,
a great deal of...
I mean, his okay. procedure may be strange, but if he has each of you check something, you know, and then he tells you how he's ruling on each of these documents, that's your opportunity to object. You should have objected then. It's just like a jury instructions. If the judge says, I'm going to object, I'm going to instruct them, you know, this or that, then that's when you have your chance to object. So similarly, when he makes, you know, decides what's going and what's not, that then we have to object. Otherwise, you're sandbagging him.
Well,
and this really was a crucial document because this whole conspiracy theory you had, the jury had to know here's where the claim was filed because your view is all the bad behavior occurred prior to the lawsuit being filed. And that this report that you say was doctored is something that came out, this May report, right? So this is, as I understand, a sequence. So it's this May report, and then in June, I guess, the complaint is filed. So the jury would say, well, where is this? You know, they've had the evidence presented, but there's a lot of teeth in that document.
Right. And I invite you to check the record to see the discussion. That's not something I reviewed extensively. I was more concerned about the record when the issue came up.
Okay, well, thank you. Well, we'll give you a minute since we asked a lot of questions after we hear from Mr. Hazelbaker. Okay.
Good morning, members of the court. If it please the court, I'm attorney Mark Hazelbaker of Madison, Wisconsin, representing the city of Evansville, the Community Insurance Company, and Officer Christopher Jones, the defendants in this case. The plaintiff's theory on this issue about the jury question answer reminds me of the fable about the princess and the pea. The princess.
Okay, well, skip the fable.
Okay.
In the reply, of course, you in your brief, you portray the suit as a complete phony, complete fraud. But in her reply brief, Ms. Everly says that many of your assertions simply have no record support. Is that correct?
I disagree. I think we supported everything in our brief by a citation of the record in the statement of facts.
Well, I'll just ask you about a particular I was just looking at it, now I can't find it.
While you're looking.
Yes, of course.
You seem to admit that the plaintiff's theory as to why the jury may have asked it, you know, the lawsuit filing date, in other words, that the jury was confusing the lawsuit with a notice of claim, is at least plausible. And you say that in your brief. Why isn't that enough to show prejudice, given that we don't know?
Because we assume that the jury was aware of and considered all of the evidence in the case.
But we've just learned that they didn't get all of the evidence in the case. But that's why we send evidence back, because we worry that perhaps missed that point. There's a real reason for sending back to a jury room. It's kind of everything in a case. You're from Wisconsin, so you're from Madison. So I take it that wasn't your first case.
Actually, it was.
Really?
Yes. I'm familiar with, from having been involved in cases, it is his practice to be selective about what he sends back. He'll give reasons on the record explaining why he thinks this or that exhibit should or shouldn't go back, but he is very selective. I don't pretend to understand his practice. I have to deal with it, of course.
Let me ask you this. Does he allow them to take notes?
He did not in this case. I don't know what his general practice is.
So they didn't have notes either. So everything is just recall.
Right. Doesn't let them take notes? What's that about?
I don't remember, actually.
That's like 50 years ago. Here's the sort of thing that bothered me, I shouldn't say bothered me. So I'm looking at page 13 of the reply brief. So under second paragraph, says defendants have no support for their assertion the plaintiffs did not offer evidence of the annual expense of Deitcher's diagnostic care. Record shows that plaintiffs presented testimony that her diagnostic care totaled $7,000 annually. The jury was given the corroborating bills. Is that a false statement or what?
I may have misspoken in my brief then with respect to the question of diagnostic care. I believe the criticism I was trying to make was that the jury didn't have enough evidence to determine what the permanent cost, the present value cost of that future care would be.
Well, they also say Dr. Levine testified the diagnostic test would be required for the rest of Deitcher's life. Now, you said, well, they didn't have his life expectancy, but then the next paragraph says that Deitcher's neurologist testified that he could live to a range of 80 to 82 years.
Well, what I said was that they didn't offer actuarial tables.
Well, what difference does that make? Right?
Well, the actual tables are usually the
Well, I know, but look, this is all very approximate. How old was Deitcher?
I don't remember standing here today, sir.
But that was in the record, wasn't it, his age? All right. So if he's... I mean, a lot of people live to... It's not clear that he couldn't live to 80 to 82.
Hopefully as many of us as possible.
So I mean, you could argue, of course, that without the actuarial evidence, but of course, you know, an individual physician's assessment of a person's condition will often be more reliable than an actuarial table, which is based on average of everybody, right? So not clear that, and of course, there are other things she says. Now, I mean, this is critical. So page 11 of the reply brief, she says, defendants have no support for the assertion that plaintiffs abandoned their home and skipped out of Evansville to escape the mortgage. And then she says, as defendants' counsel himself informed the jury, the plaintiffs left the Evansville area to escape Jimmy Reiner's.
Well, that's argument. There's an argument that we made about what part their true motive was in leaving Evansville. And there was testimony at the trial that she stopped paying the mortgage.
Well, why did you tell the jury that the plaintiffs left the Evansville area to try to escape Jimmy Reiner's? That's different from trying to escape the mortgage.
I also argued that one of the reasons they left was to escape the mortgage. There were both motives present there, sir.
So you're admitting one of the motives was to escape Reiner's?
I have no doubt that that was one of the reasons they left Evansville.
You know, the plaintiffs recovered much more than nominal damages here. Wasn't this a fairly substantial recovery, given that it is inherently difficult to establish the injury someone suffers from an invasion of privacy?
Well, it was not a nominal recovery in the sense that it was a recovery of a dollar. The issue is not whether they're eligible for a fee award, which is what the question of nominal damages goes to. The question is what the results at trial were in proportion to the relief sought. On that point...
You mean if you ask for $10 million and you only get $100,000, so it depends on what you ask for?
In part, it does, yes. The evaluation of attorney's fees in a case like this, this court's precedent has said over and over again that once the determination...
But how did he pick the figure $25,000?
I'm sorry, how?
How did he pick that figure, $25,000, for the attorney's fees?
The judge's decision explained that he looked at the lodestar...
Suspiciously round number, isn't it?
Well, it's a discretionary round number, too, Judge Posner. He decided that, looking at all the circumstances, he felt that the recovery should be no greater than the amount of damages recovered. I think that's the number he pegged it to.
But what is the basis for that? So he calculated after he subtracted some items, the fee request that reflected, you know, the amount of time properly billed, and so that's $141,000.
Correct.
So he cuts it by, 75% roughly?
87%, I think.
87%? That's
yes.
Too high. That's not, okay, 87%. So isn't that rather steep?
Well, it is steep, but the whole point of that analysis is that the considerations that the court is supposed to use within its discretion is to look at the results obtained versus the amount sought. The amount sought at trial was $1 million in punitive damages.
Are you suggesting that you should never have a fee award that's greater than the damages awarded?
No, I'm not saying that.
Well, what would justify a higher award in your view or Judge Serbaz's view?
What would justify more than $25,000?
Right.
The
right.
Conviction that the effort had been well focused and had been appropriately handled. But this is just, as this court's precedent has said, this is among the most consummately discretionary decisions.
Well, what were the defendant's fees?
I believe my fees were on the order of $120,000.
And you represented all the defendants?
Correct, sir.
If you spend $120,000 to defend, why would their $141,000 be so outlandish?
Well, because the law doesn't give prevailing defendants.
Suppose they had a good claim for $25,000. Suppose they'd been very, very modest at the beginning. They said, look, this is a thin case. our only hope is for $25,000, how much then should they have spent on litigation?
I think that's exactly the point, that if you, as a plaintiff's lawyer, you evaluate a case, yes, the law says you could aim high, but you can't aim ludicrously high.
No, look, that's ridiculous, right? Because you can't litigate a federal suit for $25,000. So what you're saying is, in effect, that you can't get a compensatory fee award for a modest claim.
No, I'm not saying that. You can get a, in fact, there's a case.
No, as I say, what if she had said, plaintiffs had said at the outset, we're just demanding $25,000. And you refuse to pay. I mean, your clients refuse to pay. So they sue. What would be the minimum they'd have to spend in order to litigate their $25,000 claim?
If they had sought what they recovered under the analysis of how prevailing attorney's fees are evaluated, they would have recovered what they sought, and they'd be entitled to the reasonable fees that they sought. That's the law.
$141,000.
Sure.
What they did wrong, in your view, was to ask for an outlandish amount.
Well, and the discipline that imposes is that it makes you get realistic instead of trying every case, because if you recover any money at all, you're going to get the full board attorney's fees that you're setting out to recover. That just doesn't.
But the problem is, if they'd asked for $25,000, you would have said, "Go jump in a lake," right? Because you would have known that they couldn't afford to litigate a $25,000
case. In fee-shifting cases, the attorney's fees become a very significant element of the settlement considerations. And if they're aiming at $25,000 and they're talking about that, with the law being that the fee awards are determined largely based on that the most important of the three criteria.
You know, but if they asked for $25,000, you would not. Settle with them, because you would know that they couldn't possibly afford to litigate a $25,000 case.
I disagree with you on that point. If it's a fee-shifting case and their offer is $25,000 and the case has any legs at all, you're running a big risk going to trial, because they could recover the $25,000, and under the Spigen case as well as the Briggs versus Marshall case talking about results obtained, they'd get that $140,000. In point of fact, that is actually one of the biggest settlement considerations
So you're saying that aren't you suggesting a new rule that if you ask for much more than you get, even though the fees you expend are reasonable in relation to what you got, because you were greedy or you had stars in your eyes or something, what I could understand is a case they ask for $6 million and your clients get desperate and they say, you know, we've got to fight this with everything. We have to hire 10 law firms, and they spend $1 million defending, and in the end the plaintiffs just get $25,000. That would be a legitimate concern about award of attorney's fees. But you defended this not as if it was a – you did not defend this as if it was a $6 million case.
Right?
Maybe I did. No, you just have $120,000, right?
Well, let me just –
If you really thought that there was a $6 million jeopardy here, you would have brought in other lawyers and so on, right?
Well, like we did. I can tell you that the number of sleepless nights I had in it suggested that.
No, let's not get into the mental distress stuff,
very,
right?
I mean, you
have mental distress. Nazira has mental distress. No, we don't want to go there.
Well, I'd like to call the court's attention to another case, Linda T. Versus Rice Lake Area School District, which is 417 Fed 3rd 704, in which there's a discussion in another context, another fee-shifting statute. If I may, Your Honor, I'd like to just quote very briefly from that. The prevailing party inquiry does not turn on the magnitude of the relief obtained, but the size of the fee award does, citing Ferrer. May I finish the quote?
No, look, you're missing the point. You admit that $141,000 is a reasonable amount to spend to get a $25,000 judgment. Your complaint is that they asked for $6 million. But look, if you could show prejudice to your clients from their having asked for $6 million, then I would think you had a really good case. And prejudice would mean, you know, you went out and you had to treat it as a big case. Clients were in jeopardy and spent a huge amount of money on discovery and all that. But I don't see what the prejudice to you was, because it still would have cost $120,000 to defend the $25,000 suit. So how were you harmed by their demand?
Under the applicable law.
I'm not asking about law. I'm asking how your defendants, how your clients were harmed by their excessive demand.
Had this case been analyzed properly, it wouldn't have been tried at all. And we're harmed because we have to pay attorney's fees to which the plaintiffs are not reasonably entitled because they didn't do a good job and didn't get a good
result.
Well,
are you saying if they just asked you for $25,000, you would have given them the $25,000?
I think we would have easily given them $25,000 because we analyzed this as a case of liability. The point is that where you've got that incentive to go for attorney's fees and to ring the bell on damages, you've got no settlement incentive at all. And the law doesn't say that you can recover your actual fees no matter what the result you obtain is. The results the results at trial is a critical factor in how much of a reasonable fee how much fee is reasonable.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hazel. So, Ms. Eberle, we'll give you 1 minute.
I did locate in the transcript where...
I was going to ask you about. I found it, too.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead. Tell the date, so for the record. The pages, rather.
It's on page 185 to 186 of the first day of the trial.
The discussion of the claim.
I'm sorry?
Or what date are you speaking of? Maybe we were on the... I found the discussion at when the question came back from the jury. And Mr. Burnham said the only piece of evidence in the record is the notice of claim, and that's what I'm trying to figure out what they're asking for. The court says no, they're asking when the case was filed. Burnham says, I don't know if that's what they mean. Court says, well, they do. They told me they meant that. And then Mr. Hazelbacher objects to it. And at some point, Burnham says, it's got to be the notice of claim, which was an admitted exhibit. And if that's what they're after and they simply misidentified it, that should go in. And the court says, you want to send a notice of claim? And and Hazelbacher objects and says they have so many exhibits. And the court responds, this is the meaningless one they want. Don't you understand? They don't want all the good stuff you gave them. They want this one. And you object to that. And then later on, after the court rules against your client, the objection is renewed to not sending it back. So the record is very clear on that.
Right, exactly. Thank you. Actually what I was addressing is your question regarding what we did initially when they didn't send
it
back.
Right.
And initially, what happened was Hazelbacher objected to that, defendants objected to that, and then we explained that the chief testified that that was the first date he ever learned of anyone mentioning the claims. And the court said, no, that's not relevant. It's like sending a complaint back. And we said, Your Honor, it's relevant because Officer Jones's position. And then we explain our position. He felt it, and we didn't just sit on our heels.
Right.
We told them this is relevant because it's when they learned of the claim, and we're talking.
It's just surprising you don't make that one of your grounds for reversal.
Okay.
Okay. Well, thank you very much to both counsel.
Thank you.
Next case.